there's a few of them that I'm getting this sense that like they know what it is. I know that she doesn't have like a genetic diagnosis, but like the way they keep looking at certain tests and going over certain things and like keep asking for certain things, like I just know that there's something in the minds of all these people that they are not telling us.
Hey, you're listening to The Rare Life. I'm your host, Madeline Cheney, and I am here with our very last story episode of season 8, Alyssa's story. When it comes to the creation and sharing of the episodes of the podcast, Alyssa and I are a two-man band, and I started out doing it all on my own for the first year and a half. So Alyssa was a total lifesaver when she joined me to make a team. I am so grateful for her and her work in the community, and I'm thrilled to share her story on the podcast today. In her story, Alyssa shares the arduous process of receiving a genetic diagnosis for her daughter Gemma as a newborn, which included an incorrect diagnosis and a brain surgery that should not have been given. We discuss the concept of trust as it relates to our children's medical team, and how to navigate that with our children's best interest as the priority, and the perspective shift that occurred when she learned of the life-limiting aspect of Gemma's diagnosis, and how suddenly every decision was made with quality of life as the number one objective. One decision that many of us parents don't get much say on is whether our children are fed by mouth or by tube, as was the case for my son Kimball and Alyssa's daughter Gemma. But one aspect of tube feeding that parents have some sway over is what our children are being tube fed. And many parents find peace in giving their tube fed children blends of foods that other kids their age are typically eating. But if the effort of making your own blends is overwhelming, it might be worth trying out commercially made blends that are stored in ready-to-use shelf-stable pouches. One great option for that is a company called Functional Formularies. They create blends of carefully selected organic, plant-based foods that are stored in shelf-stable pouches for optimal convenience. Their product, aptly called Nourish, is free of the top 9 allergens and have no artificial ingredients or sugar. And honestly, you might be surprised at how rare that is in feeding tube formula. Functional formulary products make healthy eating for tube-fed kids really easy. Let's talk insurance. Working with your child's clinician, like their GI doctor or dietitian, there is a pretty high success rate of getting insurance coverage for functional formulary products. Functional Formulary also has a team member solely dedicated to helping you navigate insurance. And if you're interested in trying out the formula before getting into mama bear mode and working to get it covered, you can ask your clinician to request a free sample from Functional Formularies. There is a link in the show notes for them to do that. If you'd like to learn more about Functional Formularies, check out their website, functionalformularies.com. Again, that's functionalformularies.com. There is a link in the show notes if you'd rather just follow that. A huge thank you to Functional Formularies for creating a product that can give us such peace of mind and for sponsoring this awesome episode. All right, a little more about Alyssa and then we'll jump in. Alyssa lives with her husband and two children, Harry, who is 7, and Gemma, who is 4.5, and also the star of today's episode. They live in Erie, Pennsylvania, which I was kind of geeking out about when I found out that she lives there forever ago, because one of my favorite comfort movies is a movie called That Thing You Do, and the movie takes place in Erie, PA, and so it made me really happy to hear that. And I'm still trying to convince Alyssa to go watch it. Anyway, when Alyssa isn't slaving away on things for The Rare Life, she works as a podcast producer for other shows. And she also just started her own podcast and platform called Caffeinated Caregivers, about advocacy for better caregiver support. There are links in the show notes to check that out as well. Alyssa is a lover of coffee and of swimming. All right, let's dive in. Pun intended. Hi, Alyssa. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Madeline. It's fun to be here.
Yeah, this is
kind of fun.
This will be super great. I think it's definitely will be a cool thing to like hear your story like officially, because obviously we know each other super well. We talk almost every day. And yet I don't know your story with Gemma like from start to finish, or at least like in depth. So I'm excited to hear about it. So as you know the drill. Let's start out with when you first knew that anything was going on with Gemma, like medically.
Yeah, I feel like I should say, like, we do talk almost every day. So it's not that you don't know the story of Gemma because I'm like keeping secrets. I just haven't told very many people the story from front to back. So Gemma is my second child. I have an older son named Harry. He's just under like 3 years older than she is. So when we first found out that something was going on with Gemma, it was at her 11-week ultrasound, right? Wow. And I didn't really think going into that appointment. It was my second kid. So I was like, okay, we go in, we do the ultrasounds. Not a big deal. They just like tell you you're pregnant, basically, that first ultrasound at like 8 to 12 weeks or whatever. So I go into that like very first appointment and they do the blood work and they do the ultrasound. And so they're taking forever. They're like looking and looking and looking. And I was like, this is weird because I've done this before. I know what this is supposed to be like and this is taking a long time, but it was a different doctor. We had moved in between the two babies, so I didn't think too much about it until they were like, okay, we're done with the ultrasound. Why don't you go back to the doctor's office and just like wait in there for a little bit? So we did, and like there weren't doctors at this office, and we'll get into this in a little bit, but like there wasn't like an actual OB in the office at the time. There was just like a PA. So she comes in and the conversation is more or less like, there's something wrong with your baby. Like, we don't know exactly what it is, but like her brain doesn't look right.
Wow.
And that sounds very vague, like a thing that like doctors wouldn't tell you in terms like that. But that was more or less what they said to me. It was no information like whatsoever. So we did the really basic like NIPT testing and stuff like that in there. And then they were like, okay, well, go home. We'll do another ultrasound in a couple weeks and just see if this is a fluke or whatever.
Well, that's like wild to me, because of all the people I've ever interviewed on here, and there's been a lot, like especially like, you know, story episodes, like no one has found out that early on. Like that is so early that they could tell stuff about her brain. That blows my mind.
Yeah. I don't know all the details, but yeah, there are like certain little structures in the brain that are already developing at that point, and like hers didn't look like they typically look. Wow. Like there were already like spaces where they weren't supposed to be. So anyway, there was that. Obviously, I'm freaking out, but I was like, I'm not going to like lose my mind until we go to the second ultrasound. You never know. I've done this pregnancy thing before. Things can look different. We'll see what happens.
So how long was it between that ultrasound and your next appointment?
My next one was 2 weeks later. So I was 13 weeks, like very end of the first trimester for this one. So I show up at the hospital radiology ward or whatever. I just walk into like the ultrasound thing. There's an ultrasound tech there. She does the ultrasound and then she's like, yep, looks the same. She was like, okay, you can go now. And I was like, what do you mean I can go now? She was like, well, you know, there's nothing really new on this one from the last one. So I don't have anything to tell you. And I was like, yeah, but I didn't get any information the first time. What do you mean?
Same as what?
Right. Yeah. I'm like, my baby's brain is not developing. And you're just like, okay, go home now. I was like, no, there's got to be someone here. Do you not have like a doctor in this hospital? Like, what is going on here? And she was baffled by that. She was like, well, you don't have an appointment with a doctor. And I'm like, how do I not have an appointment with the doctor? So basically, they had to run around the OB ward and like found some poor OB who, I don't know if he was assigned to my case or not, to just talk to me. And he was basically like, well, the brain doesn't look right. We don't know what that means. It's super early. Also, we don't have any doctors here. I live not in like a super small town, but I don't live like in a major metro area, mm-hmm. right? Like we have some nearby. So they're like, you're going to have to go down to Pittsburgh in our case, because that was the affiliated hospital. We'll telehealth you in to like talk to somebody in the meantime. So again, basically the whole conversation is like, something's wrong with her brain. Okay, bye.
Wow.
So we did do a telehealth appointment, but immediately after that, I was like, we're not doing this. We're getting another doctor. Mm-hmm. We're not dealing with this health system or whatever. So we did right after that switch. I live in between like Cleveland and Pittsburgh. And so we were with the health system that was part of Pittsburgh. We switched over to Cleveland. So for the rest of the pregnancy, I was driving an hour and a half every time we had to go to an appointment. But that seemed worth it to me because those doctors seemed much better organized and had more information. Yeah. You know, I went through their OB process. We had an MFM. We had ultrasounds all the time, like all kinds of blood work. But for her pregnancy, that was really the big, most jarring part of it, was just at the beginning. We didn't get a whole lot more answers. You have spaces in your brain where your spinal fluid is, and Gemma's were like really, really big. So that could be ventriculomegaly, which just means that those ventricles are really big. It could be hydrocephalus, which means the ventricles are big because there's a lot of pressure in her brain. In the ultrasound, they really couldn't tell which one of those. So it was just a lot of monitoring from there on out. We had planned out basically what her birth was going to look like. She was going to have a scheduled C-section, which we ended up doing. And we met with some specialists and stuff beforehand. But for the rest of my pregnancy with her, it was basically just planning. So it was stressful, but stressful not so much in like the events are happening sense, but like we're just like waiting.
The waiting game.
Totally. We didn't end up doing an amnio with her for like a few reasons. One, because we were told essentially that like it wasn't necessarily going to change her prenatal care at all because they can't like do anything ahead of time. And there's always the risk of, you know, miscarriages or early births or whatever. So we're like, we're not going to risk it. She was born at like a really big national hospital. So I'm like, they have everything there. We're already prepared. It's not a big deal to like do that ahead of time.
I think that's a thing. Like for a lot of parents I've heard and like talking to different parents, like I was in that situation too of like, do we do the amnio when this child is like higher risk anyway to know how to better prepare for them? But like at the same time, it won't really change anything. So it is like this really tricky situation.
That's like a theme in all of this too. Like what do you decide to test for and like what you don't and the reasons for all of that. Yeah. But we did go ahead with the scheduled C-section. She was born at 39 weeks. She wasn't premature, but obviously like it was planned for her to go to the NICU. The prevailing idea at the time was that she had hydrocephalus because that's a fairly common brain defect among children where they have a lot of the pressure. So we had already talked about if that's what she has, she'll go to the NICU and then she'll have surgery pretty soon after because in her case, it's pretty severe because her ventricles are very enlarged. So we were hoping that like we could see her for a couple minutes right after she was born. And they did bring her in super quick. She was breathing and everything after, but then got whisked right up to the NICU. You know, the thing with like scheduled C-sections and NICU babies like that, there's not a ward for moms to stay in the NICU, right? So like you go to your floor to recover from just giving birth, and then your baby goes to the other side of the hospital. We got lucky. In my case, my parents were there with me, so they could come with me and like make sure that everything was fine on my end. And then we had already decided that like my husband was going to go with Gemma right away. And I was like, you know, you need to get all the details that you can, because like we don't know what's going on. I don't know what's going on. Like I'm not even in the room. Yeah. Like you're going to have to figure out as much as you can here. Yeah,
which I think is like a really interesting thing to think about, like for the dad's perspectives of all this. Like you're there with the birth and stuff, and then like you are the eyes and the ears for the mom. Like a lot of times that was Justin for me. Like it's just so fascinating.
Mm-hmm. The dad commentary.
Yeah.
But anyway, so despite, again, the fact that like we knew there was stuff going on and she was whisked off to the NICU right away, a lot of that was because they were just going to do a ton of testing. She wasn't having issues breathing. She was having a little issue eating. Like they ran an NG tube right away and stuff. But she was pretty stable, all things considered. But pretty quickly, they brought in a neurologist. And we had met with a neurologist before Gemma was born. But it was a different neurologist than the one that showed up in the NICU. So we had this guy. She's 3 days old. We're sitting in a conference room because they're like, okay, we've run all the tests. We've done all the imaging. This is what she has. It's called Dandy-Walker syndrome. It's defined by like all these markers that she has. She did not have all those markers. We'll get to that in a minute. But they were like, she has some of these markers and it sort of looks like this. Also, hydrocephalus is like a big component of that usually. So it's worth saying here that like usually when kids have hydrocephalus, babies have that little soft spot on their head, their fontanelle. So typically in hydrocephalus, there's a lot of pressure on the brain. So that will be puffed up a lot. Gemma's was the opposite. Hers was sunken in almost. And that can be a marker of a lot of things. But it also tells you that like there's not pressure happening on the brain. But they still told us that she had hydrocephalus. And they were like, okay, she must have severe hydrocephalus because her ventricles are huge. So we're going to do surgery. We're going to put a shunt in to drain fluid from her brain so like we can deal with the pressure.
Well, and like I'm reading between the lines here. She didn't have hydrocephalus, did she?
No.
And she didn't have Dandy Walker syndrome.
She didn't have Dandy Walker syndrome. Nope.
And they're about to perform a brain surgery.
Yes.
Based off an incorrect diagnosis. Oh my God.
So the other thing too is that their typical neurosurgeon who usually does like the baby surgeries at that hospital, she was out of town for like that whole week. But they were like, it's got to happen now because if she has hydrocephalus and it's really bad, like the sooner the better. So they're like, we have this other guy from another hospital. He'll come in and he'll do the surgery. And this is one of those things where like if we had been around the medical system more, there would have been a lot more red flags going up because we had a really good NICU nurse team in that hospital and we had already befriended one of the nurses and she was like, you know, you can wait or you can ask for a different surgeon. You don't have to do this right now. Like she wasn't telling us what to do, obviously, but she was dropping a lot of hints.
And she's probably internally having like, oh my gosh, these parents need to like question this.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, but then on the other end, the like NICU team and then the neurologist and then obviously the neurosurgeon are like, no, we got to do it like yesterday. Every minute you wait is like a big deal.
I feel like our stories are sort of similar because like prenatal thing and it's like, at that point, when you don't have like experience in the medical system in that way, it's kind of like, please tell me what to do. Don't make me make any decisions. I have no idea. So like when it's like the surgeon saying something like that, I feel like there's definitely this like, well, I'm going to trust the highest up person. Now I know differently. I don't know. I feel like there is this like almost ignorance when you first go into it of like kind of trusting everything because they're like so educated.
Totally. And you think that you're supposed to, right? Like you show up and you're like, yeah. I'm not a doctor. If anyone's supposed to know, it's like this team, right?
Right.
How would I be able to make that decision? And like you have a lot of faith in these teams and in these people. And then all of a sudden, some point down the line, you realize that like doctors have a lot of expertise, but like they don't necessarily know what to do in your kid's situation either.
Yeah. No, it's like a coming of age story. That moment of like, this belief that you had and then it gets shattered, like you said, and that's a really scary feeling. It's very jarring.
Mm-hmm. We've done a lot of foreshadowing. So actually what happens first is not that they took back their initial diagnosis. What happened first is that she had been pretty stable before, but then coming out of her surgery, it took her on and off 4 days to come off of respiratory support. Like she came out of the surgery. She's 8 days old. She's on the ventilator. They try and like pull the vent like a day later and she has like this big, huge crash. So we go back to the drawing board, put her back on the vent and then do like a 3 day wean off of the vent. And then it's going fairly well until 3 or 4 days later and the stitches on her scalp. So it was a poorly planned surgery from the beginning. I'm not going to get into all the details, but like the way that he did the surgery is really probably not a thing that you should do on an 8 day old with like a maybe diagnosis. So Essentially what happened is that her stitches on two parts of her head, both of those started to come undone. There's like spinal fluid like leaking out behind her ear and it's a bad situation, right? Because like this is a tiny baby, like that's a huge infection risk right where her brain is. It's a whole thing. And part of the reason that we felt comfortable doing this surgery in the first place is because they're like, you know, obviously there's risks to everything. But as far as brain surgeries go, getting a shunt is a pretty simple surgery. There's not a lot of complications. So it should be fine. So then it's not healing, like it's not going fine. And I asked the NICU doctor who had 30 years of tenure at that point, and he's not part of the neurology team. He's the one who's like running the team in the actual baby ward. So he's seen tons and tons and tons of baby surgeries at this point. And I was like, okay, is this a thing that happens? How often does this happen, like with the shunts? And he's like, I can count on one hand how many times I've seen this in like 30 years.
Oh,
so at that point, yeah, we were like, something is happening here. You know, she goes back, the better surgeon shows up now and like they do her second surgery. She comes off the vent like a lot better for that. But now the whole NICU team is like in an uproar about like, they think she had a seizure at one point. There's just all this stuff going on. And they're like, okay, it's probably not Dandy Walker syndrome. Or if it is, it's like part of something else. Like we got to get to the bottom of this. So they started testing everything. And also in that process, like the team has switched over now because Gem is about 3 weeks old as all of this is happening. So we've been in the NICU for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. So the neurologist, not the one that diagnosed her with Dandy Walker, but the one that we had seen before she was born, shows back up. And he comes in and I can't remember exactly how he phrased it, but more or less he was like, I'm pretty sure it's not Dandy Walker syndrome. Like, that's basically the first thing he said to us. And the way that he said it, I just had this sense, like, right away. I was like, okay, do you know what it is? And he wouldn't tell us, but he was like, I'm pretty sure it's genetic. We need to look for mitochondrial diseases. But the way that he said it with such certainty, I was like, this guy has an idea of what's going on already. And so they had a geneticist come in after that. I don't know. And like, you just meet some doctors and we're already really skeptical about everything at this point. And like, I met this guy and he was like, it could be this, it could be that. We'll do full exome testing. It could take 6 to 8 weeks. We could do it faster, but it'll cost $40,000 to get it done in like 2 weeks. Yeah. It's still just like swirling around at this point. Anyway, needless to say, did not have like a lot of faith in that guy. And the other thing is that at some point, like, we have all these different doctors talking to us. Different ones are telling us different things. They're all pretty sure that she doesn't have Dandy Walker syndrome right now. But there's a few of them that I'm getting this sense that they know what it is. I know that she doesn't have like a genetic diagnosis, but like the way they keep looking at certain tests and going over certain things and like keep asking for certain things, like, I just know that there's something in the minds of all these people that they are not telling us. And that was proven to be completely correct. At this point, the first NICU team, like I said, had switched over. The very first NICU doctor that we had, the one that I'd asked about Gemma's surgery, I really liked him. He was really good. He did a lot of like hand-holding for us. He walked us through a lot of things. The one that came on next, we didn't like so much. And I found out later that like they had a lot of disagreements about just the kind of care that like Gemma was supposed to receive. So at one point, that first doctor shows back up.
And that's the one who you're like, he knows. That's the one you're talking
about. Yeah, okay. We know. We trust him. He pulls us aside. He's like, if anybody asks you, like, this conversation didn't happen. Like, I didn't tell you this. But
oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I know.
The drama.
Oh, God. Oh, right. But he's like, all right, you need to ask for a transfer because I'm pretty sure Gemma has this particular disease. It's a metabolic disease. They don't have a metabolic team here at the hospital that you're at. But 1 mile down the road in also an extremely good hospital with a really good NICU, they have a team that specifically studies the disease that I'm pretty sure your daughter has. He's like, oh, you need to ask for a transfer and you need to go there. They are not going to give you a transfer. Apparently, lots of conversations had been happening behind the scenes that like we were not even part of.
So he said they're not going to give you one. So what are you supposed to do?
So the day after this conversation happens, it's just me in the NICU because like my mom had to go back home. Sam is back at work. The other thing is like none of our like normal nurses were there that day because it was like their day off. And this doctor the night before was like, you have to request a transfer because they're not even going to tell you that it's a good idea to go there. But like you really need to go there. So it's just me walking into this team that hasn't really been very friendly to us up until this point. And I'm like, okay, I want a NICU transfer to this hospital that's literally a mile down the road. And they were like, why? And I was like, well, I think that she should go there. That's why. Because I also can't tell them like, oh, this doctor showed up last night and was like, go do all this, right? Because I'm not supposed to tell anyone because he can get in big trouble.
What answer are you supposed to give? Like, I just feel like we should go.
So the team in there starts the paperwork, and this is at like 9 a.m., and all day they drag their feet. Every hour on the hour, they're sending like another doctor to me, like another specialist that's like, are you sure you want to do this? We can do all this stuff here. Tell me again that you want to transfer. So like 6 or 7 times during that day, I had to be like, yes, I want a transfer. Just bring me the paperwork.
That sounds so uncomfortable. Was that like so uncomfortable for you, like to have to keep saying that when you're like, I can't even tell you why, but I have to keep like BSing through this?
I'll tell you, even now, like 4.5 years later, probably the hardest day of her entire time in the NICU was like that day to have dozens of medical professionals come in and basically tell you that like you're making the wrong choice. You're making a bad decision. And me just like saying it over and over again. And the other thing is like I've had like some medical stuff in my past. So like I already have like a really big dissociative response. So like as soon as all this stuff starts happening, like I just like shut down. So like there's no feelings, like there's no processing of what's happening. I had one nurse. She was actually really nice and she was like very stern. She came up to me. She's like, I'm not getting a lot from you right now. I see your face and like, there's not a lot happening here. I was like, yeah, it's not going to. I just don't respond that way.
Just checked out.
Yeah. And so she's like, all right, well, do you want this transfer? And I was like, I want this transfer. This transfer has to happen. She's like, all right, I'll make sure it happens.
Oh, bless the Stern nurses. I took care of it. Wow.
Yeah, she did make it happen. She ran some interference for us and she got us the paperwork. And at like 5 o'clock that day, we got our transfer. It's a voluntary transfer, so I did have to pay out of pocket, not covered by insurance, the ambulance ride from NICU to NICU.
Oh my gosh. So all these things, and you're just like, no, I trust this doctor. This is the person I trust because he gave us insight into like what they're talking about behind closed doors and not telling us.
Right, because it had been so clear up to that point that there's something happening here and they're not giving us the information. People know things and they're not telling us. And then they're coming in and they're like, okay, but you'll have to trust us that like we're making the best decision for you. And I'm like, I don't have very much information to go on to make me think that that would be true, right? Because you've already given us a mixed diagnosis. You've already given me a surgeon who's like messed up my kid's head. And then now she's like recovering from a second one. We have all these missteps that have happened up to this point. And then you're telling me, but like, we don't even have a team for the disease that some people think that my daughter has here, but we can give her the best care. And I'm like, how am I supposed?
Like, that sounds like a business decision on their part, not like in the best interest of.
I have tried to make sense of the like why they refuse to give us a transfer. It doesn't make sense because it's not uncommon for kids in various hospitals to get transferred to other places when they have specialties that you don't, right? Like that's a normal thing that happens. So why didn't that happen with Gemma? And the best thing that I can come up with is like they knew already that like they messed up that first week with the bad diagnosis and the bad surgery. And like if they keep it in-house, maybe they could manage it.
Yeah. Or they're like almost embarrassed. Like they don't want other people to find out.
Totally. Yeah. Well, we're just 4 weeks in now. She's only 4 weeks old. We get our transfer to our second hospital.
And you just had like a C-section too.
I just had
like,
a C-section.
That's not even out of the recovery of that yet, right? Isn't that like 6 to 8 weeks to recover from that? Or is that longer?
Yeah, I still have stitches. I'm still like wearing my like band as I'm shuffling like down hallways every single day to like get to the NICU.
Oh my gosh.
So their genetics team shows up. The first doctor that walks into the room is like, she has PDCD. It's pyruvate dehydrogenase complex deficiency. So this is her actual real diagnosis.
And this happens the day you get transferred.
The day we get transferred. So she hasn't had her genetic testing yet, but they study that disease over there. And he goes, she has every marker. He's like, she's got the high lactate. She's not recovering well from surgeries. She has ventricles and like all these like brain malformations, but she doesn't have pressure. I'm 99% sure it's PDCD. We have a proprietary test where we can run the 10 most common genes and we'll know within a week if it's that.
Oh my gosh.
Spoiler alert, it was that. And she has the most common genetic marker.
Wow.
So like, that's a thing. In any other like case, it's like, okay, that should be the end of the story, right? Except what happens next is from her second surgery, we're in a different hospital now. And a day after we get there, her scalp stitches her second surgery that she had are coming
with the good surgeon.
With the good surgeon are coming undone. And so all this other diagnosis stuff is like happening. And I'm like, okay, I get that that's important, but also like my kid's skull is like being exposed. And the nurses keep coming in and the doctors are like, well, maybe that's what's happening. But none of them want to get involved in this more than they have to. They don't want to mess with like a surgical site on a tiny baby who doesn't heal well, who's already had surgery twice. And I'm freaking out because I'm like, no, I know that this is happening again because I watched it happen the first time. So like every 15 minutes, I'm like coming over, taking pictures of her scalp. I'm texting Sam, who's still, he still has to work. You don't get like weeks off of time. He's a professor.
Even for medically complex babies.
Right. So I'm texting him pictures and I'm like, I don't know what to do. Nobody seems like super concerned about it here. So actually what I ended up doing is I had the PA's phone number for that second surgeon. Like she had given us all her stuff. She was like, we'll keep in contact. She's at a different hospital, so she can't do anything. But I text her PA and I was like, here's the pictures. This is what's happening. Nobody over here is taking this seriously. I was like, I need help. So she gets all that information. She's like, well, obviously I'm not at the hospital with you. But all the like fancy neurosurgeons are all like colleagues and they're all in the same city. So they all talk. So she called her colleague at this new hospital. And this new colleague is like all business. 30 minutes like after I send that text message, the neurosurgeon shows up in our hospital room.
And like That's a big deal, too. We work with neurosurgeons, too, with Kimball. Like, for the actual neurosurgeon to come down is, like we never saw them.
Within an hour of, like, starting all this, like, she shows up in the room. She looks at Gemma's stitches. Wow. She's like, this is coming undone. This is a really bad situation. We're going to plan surgery, and she's going to get another surgery tomorrow. And so she did.
Oh, my gosh.
We did a third surgery.
So the first surgery that was done, like, that shouldn't have been done. Like, at this point, if they hadn't made that mistake, she wouldn't have had any surgeries, right? These are all just to repair that first mistake. These are not, like, to help with the syndrome. It's just like, oh, dang, we cut her skull open. We shouldn't have. And we're still trying to, like, fix that.
That's exactly it.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, she has this, like, crazy rare genetic disorder. And I can't even pay attention to that because I'm like, I can see part of her head.
Like, put a pin in, like, the whole, like, trajectory of her whole life. I can't deal with that right now. We got to keep her alive.
I know, right? I was like, her brain is being exposed to air. Ugh. Yeah, so she does her third surgery. This new surgeon, like I said, she's all business. So Gemma comes back from her surgery. Again, the neurosurgeon comes back to the NICU ward with Gemma, with her team. She gets, like, all the people around, and she's like, she's going to be sedated. Nobody touches her. She doesn't get upset. She doesn't get hungry. She doesn't get this. We keep the lights low. This is it. We're leaving her alone for 3 days, and these stitches are going to heal, because if we don't, then it's going to be, like, a really big deal. If this surgery doesn't heal, then we're looking at, like, months of, like, reconstructive surgeries.
Oh, my gosh.
Her plan worked. And finally, when all of that was happening, that's when we got, like, her official diagnosis. That was when the genetic test actually came back. That official genetics test came about 5 days after we did the transfer. And I actually really like this doctor. To this day, we are still with this geneticist. But I have to say, the diagnosis delivery did not go well, because, like, he just showed up, and he has, like, his, like, research team show up with him. But the primary NICU doctor isn't there, the one that, like, sees a lot of parents and runs a lot of interference for doctors who are not great at, like, delivering news and stuff like that. They don't have a social worker. They don't have anybody. And the lights are dark because Gemma's still recovering from surgery, and we're talking in, like, you know, like, whispers. And my husband is not there because we didn't know that we were going to get the diagnosis that day. And so this guy shows up and is like, yep, it's all this. These are all the things that happened with this disease, which is, like, all kinds of, like, systemic neurological effects and lots of things. And it's also a life-limiting diagnosis. He's like, you know, we'll keep her going as long as we can. Maybe 2 years, maybe 4 years, maybe 15 years. And that's what he says. And most kids do die within childhood. Up until that point, we had gone through all these things with Gemma. And I was never that worried about, like, the disability aspect. I know that seems simple to say, but through all these things, I was like, you know what? If she has a disability, whatever, we'll figure it out. That doesn't matter. I just want to have her. I want her to live. I want her to be with us. So, like, as long as we have that, we can figure everything else out. So, like, he says that, and it's just all of this stuff has happened up until this point. But that was, like, that, like, bomb drop silence moment. Or you're, like, trying to, like, process. Did you just tell me that, like, my kid's gonna die? But we had looked up PDCD beforehand, and that was, like, one of the markers. Most kids don't make it out of childhood. That was just kind of it. Like, after that, it was like, well, her surgery is done. We're starting treatment for her new disease. She's on a ketogenic diet. Like, that's the best way they have to manage her disease and all of that. And from there, it was relatively uneventful. Like, her surgery did eventually heal. Although, I have to say, we did eventually get to go home. But when they took her stitches out for her last surgery, one little stitch part got left in. So we get home, and then, like, 3 days after we're home, I see this, like, little infected spot on her scalp. And I lost it, right? Because I was like, this is happening again. It wasn't a big deal. It was just, like, a tiny, like, skin thing. They just had to go back and, like, pull it out. But it was one of those moments where you're like, what else can happen?
Yeah, totally. Well, okay, I want to, like, when you got the prognosis where there were, like, a lot of kids don't even make it out of childhood, right? Like, and you were saying, like, as long as we can keep her, we'll handle whatever happens. And then they're like, well, you're not going to be able to, basically, right? Obviously, I imagine there was a total shift in how everything felt after that, right? Like kind of like the before and after of finding that out. Like, okay, like we're dealing with these doctors that are just like making mistakes and like we're just trying to deal with them and figure out what the heck to do. And she's healing from the surgery and da-da-da. And then like finding out that information of like she's going to pass away. Like we don't get to keep her forever. And then continuing, right? Like, oh, and then now the stitches are infected and like, da-da-da. Like how did that shift how you felt about her care and like the things that were happening at that point, like that just kept going, right? Like it sounds like it's kind of pretty much the same thing, right? Like things didn't change that much as far as her care, but like how did that shift how you handled it or like felt during that?
So I was already, as much as I was capable at the time, angry about what had happened to us like at the first hospital. And I already knew that things had been handled poorly up until that point. But getting that news that like, okay, now we've done all of this and it was unnecessary and she's going to have a short life and we just spent all these weeks and all these unnecessary surgeries and all this suffering for no reason. She shouldn't have to go through all of this. So it did shift a lot of things like really quickly. I think a lot of parents have this moment too, and you've had an episode about it, right? Where like you start to think about like therapies differently and treatment differently and like, okay, do we go down every avenue to like just quote unquote fix as many things as we can, make them as like quote unquote capable or independent or whatever as they can be? Or do we just lean really hard into like quality of life? You know, not saying that you're not doing things, but it's like, okay, if we're going to do anything, if we're going to do any kind of testing, any kind of procedures, any kind of like really difficult therapy, it better have like a really, really good outcome.
And like now, right? Like not like, oh, you know, when she's 30, her gait will be improved or whatever. It's like, no, it needs to improve her life now to make it worth it.
Right. It needs to make a difference like next month or next year maybe, or we're probably not going to do it. And that's kind of tricky coming out of the NICU too, right? Because the first thing they do is get you into like early intervention and they're like 8 million therapists. 8 million like specialists, all this stuff.
Yes.
And if you don't go do it, they're like, why haven't you done this yet? Why haven't you done this yet? Why haven't you seen this specialist yet?
Like, oh, like the grieving parent, like this is just because she's so, you know, like emotional or like.
Totally. And I'm like, no, we're looking at this completely differently. Mm-hmm. We had one doctor, like I would tell them, I'm like, she has a life-limiting prognosis. And I had at least one doctor tell me like, well, you don't know that for sure. And I was like, I do, actually. I'm like, I don't know if it's going to be like 5 or like 20, but I know she's not making it to like 40 or 50. These kids don't live that long. So I do know that. So first of all, rude. And second of all, like this is going to be the way that we approach this, whether or not you like it, because it's not your kid. And again, yeah. We had finally reached that point where it's like, not only do you not have to listen to the doctor, but like sometimes the doctors make bad decisions that negatively impact your child.
Well, it feels like a shift too of like before it was like the number one concern was like we need to keep her alive at all costs, right? Like that's what every parent's instinct is.
Totally.
And then I think it's almost like after you find out like, okay, this is life limiting, it's like we are protecting her quality of life at all costs, right? Like kind of that shift. And of course, I'm sure you're doing things to like keep her alive longer and like you're not just like, oh, well, we're not even going to do any preventative care or whatever. But like almost like we're protected because sometimes those are at odds, right? And I'm sure you guys have come up against that. Like, are we going to make this decision based on quality of life or this decision, which more testing and more invasive surgeries and things like that?
Well, actually, a really good example of this is she still has her VP shunt. Like that third surgery heals. So she still has this like device in her brain that is turned off. Like it doesn't do anything because she doesn't need it. And we've had conversations with other neurosurgeons now who are like, well, we should take it out because there might be problems later or all these sort of things. And I'm like, I'm not doing another brain surgery on her until something happens and it has to come out now. I'm like, I'm just not doing it. Like I know that there are risks to leaving it in, but right now that doesn't outweigh the difficulty that it would put her through to like try and take it out.
Well, not only that, but it's like, think about your experience here where you're like, they told me it was a low risk surgery. Yeah. They told me it was absolutely the best thing to do. And guess what kept happening? It's kind of like the whole like the rare diagnosis thing. Like I hear a lot of people say like, my kid's 1 out of 125. If you tell me something's not likely to happen because it's so rare, it's like, try me. Rare happens to us. That's who it happens to. I don't know. I feel like that translates over to this where you're like, yeah, sure. Sure, it's low risk. But like, she's fine right now. Why are we going to take that risk in doing that?
It is that same thing. Yeah. You're just like, no, No, the worst has happened. The like worst case scenario has already played out at least twice in our case. Like, you're not touching her head again unless it's like a really, really important thing.
Yeah. Okay, well, here's a question. So, like, I know this is like a big, because we've talked, you know, outside of this, like a big thing with the whole trust in the medical system, or like once that trust is completely broken in your case, in a lot of people's case. What has your experience been now? Like, how old is Gemma now? She's like...
She's 4 and a half.
So now, like, years later, what does that look like? Like, what is your relationship with her care team? Are you, like, questioning everything, like, almost to an unhealthy level because of that trauma? Do you feel like you're at a good, like, balance? Like, where are you with that?
In a lot of ways, like, our trust was completely broken with certain doctors. But even in that experience, we had some bright spots. We had that very first NICU doctor who risked his whole career basically to get us like where we needed to be. And he had helped us a lot up until that point. So it's like my trust broadly in that hospital was broken, but like my trust in that doctor wasn't, because he took a really big risk for us. And I just sort of briefly touched on it, but like at that first hospital in particular, even though we had all those issues, like we just had an incredible like nursing team. And one of those nurses, like I still keep in contact with today, and they helped us out a lot too. So in all of this, there's all these bright spots. And even this genetics doctor who, again, diagnosis delivery was terrible. And like that was a really rough start to our relationship. Yeah. But Gemma, when she was around a year old, she got hospitalized with RSV twice in 1 month. And so she went through the ER department. We were in our local hospital. You've probably experienced this where you show up at a local hospital with an ER with like a kid with a really rare disease. And like whoever's the doctor in there just has this like terrified look on their face. They're like, oh my God, what do I do with this? You know? So she stayed at that hospital. She didn't have to be intubated on either of those. But that geneticist, who again is like one of the biggest geneticists like in his field, one of the only doctors who like studies this disease, was calling every day to like give guidance to the children's ward there. Like, this is what you need to do for Gemma. This is what you need to look at. Like, this is, and also backing up all the things that I said, right? You know, because we walk into here and I'm like, if you bring anything with sugar into this room, I'm going to make you take it back out, because she can't have sugar. She has a super high ratio keto diet. And the reason she has a super high ratio keto diet is because her body does not process carbohydrates at all. It makes her lactate shoot through the roof. It's like not good when she's already sick. So they show up with like kids Tylenol and I'm like, that's not going to work. Go find some pills to crush up or something. And the doctors, you know, locally are like, that seems like a lot. But then you have this other geneticist on the other line who's backing up all the things that we say. And like, that was a big deal too.
Like giving you credibility.
Totally. Yeah. It's just taken a lot longer, I would say. Like we have some doctors that like we really have a good relationship with and like we really trust a lot. And we have in-home nurses, right? And it's taken us a long time to like get our nursing team to like where we want it. But that has helped a lot. Like Gemma has a lot of nurses who really, really care about her. And that's helped. I will say that like I think it's probably harder to be a doctor coming on to our care team, because I just had to go to a new one kind of recently. And she was, the short version is, I didn't really want to go there. And I didn't really think Gemma needed it. And so I told her that. She was like, why are you here today? And I was like, I honestly don't really know. We're here because this other doctor made me come here. And like, I'm not sure what you can do for us. And she was actually, to her credit, super cool about it. And she's like, you know, I totally get your concerns. Like, we're not going to do anything that isn't like super necessary. We can just like watch this. So, I mean, I think that's hard. Like now off the bat, like, I don't even wait. I'm like, you have to prove that you're trustworthy to me before we even start. Gemma had her adenoids taken out at one point. And the first ENT that we went to was like, we're going to take out her adenoids. We're going to take out her tonsils. We're going to do all this stuff. And I was like, well, I don't think she needs that. And he's like, well, if we're going to go in and take out her adenoids, we might as well take out her tonsils. Now, up until this point, remember, she has historically not healed well from surgeries. Mm-hmm. Also, they told me beforehand when we had done all the testing up until this point that like she has like the tiniest tonsils in the whole world and like giant adenoids. And also, a tonsil surgery is harder to recover from than an adenoid surgery. And I was like, I don't want to do our tonsils. And he's like, well, we're going to do our tonsils. So it's fine. We just switched ENTs to one that was like, yeah, we can just do adenoids. So
yeah, like we're not even messing with you.
No, I didn't even tell him that day. I just like, we left that appointment. We didn't schedule the surgery. I called up one at a different hospital. I don't even like pause for that now. I'm like, well, if you do something and I don't think it's going to be the best for her, like I'm just going to find a different team.
Bye. Yeah, I think that's a really smart way to go about it, because it's like at that point, I bet you're just looking at him like, we're not going to work together. Like if you're pushing back against me like that and just like, no, we're going to do this, you're not going to be on my team.
Well, because you have those doctors, right, who like you come in and they're like, this is how most kids handle this. But to your point earlier, it's like, well, we have rare kids. They don't handle all of this mm-hmm. like other kids do. So why would you treat their case like most other kids, especially when you have a parent telling you that like they don't do well with this historically?
Yeah. It's like, I've got all the evidence, but I'm not going to sit here and try to convince you, because you're obviously not a very good doctor if you're going to like argue with me.
Nope.
I really like that. I think that's like a really good takeaway for a lot of parents right now, like especially like ones that are earlier on and might be like, oh my gosh, that sounds so bold. But it's like, you literally don't have to say anything. You're like, okay, and then like just don't schedule it and get a new one.
Yeah. They're like, what date would you like? And you're like, I'll call you back. And then you don't. They have plenty of other kids that are going to be in there. They can take out the adenoids of like 1,000 quote unquote typical children, you know, but they don't have to do my daughter if they're not going to like listen to my opinion on things. And same with everybody else.
Yeah.
Call and get a new specialist. Like your primary care person can refer you to someone else. And even if they don't, I actually don't do referrals through my primary care physician anymore. I just call doctors' offices. Most health plans are like this, I think, now. But like where you don't have to have referrals to see specialists, like you can just go, especially with certain diagnoses. So that's what we do. I don't even bother with that. I'm just like, well, that's it for you. On to the next.
Yeah. Yeah. Bye. You're the care team manager. And so, yeah, I really like that. So like in conclusion, it sounds like you have a really healthy level of trust in the system. You're like, I will trust you if you earn it.
Pretty
but I'm
much.
Not going to trust any old doctor that's like, I'm a doctor, listen to me. And you're like, not if you're taking her tonsils. No.
I mean, it is a tricky situation to be in, right? Because it's not like mm-hmm. we cannot work with our care teams, right? Like our kids have so many yeah. specialists and so many things that they need from these specialists. But at the same time, it's like, well, you know, your opinion counts too. Because we know our kids and like we have watched them go through some of just like the craziest situations. Like I know that like the story with Gemma seems like wild, but mm-hmm. there's people that have like crazier stories than us too. And like yeah. you still have to work with these care teams. So it just, you just get really careful and much more bold. Mm-hmm. Like you just worry a lot mm-hmm. less about doctors' feelings. Cause it's like, you know,
yeah.
they have big egos. They'll recover. It's fine. But your kid might not. Your kid might not.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a good line. One, like, you know what it's like to sit there and be like, they made a mistake and now my child is going through this extra suffering because of that mistake they made. So I feel like that solidifies in your head of like, nope, that's not happening again. Who cares whose feelings I hurt? Like, I'm not letting that happen again.
Absolutely.
Okay, so like we're going to like shift gears intensely here. Like,
yeah,
I want to hear. Personally, I want to hear, I don't know if listeners are curious about this, but like as like the, I put a lot of slashes, you're the editor slash producer slash graphic designer slash social media, whatever, like all the things that you do for us, which I am so grateful for. I can never go back to doing it all myself. What's your story of like when you messaged me and like, hey, I know podcast editing, when I was like, I need an editor. I don't know. What's your side of the story with that?
Yeah, I have told you this before. I found your, I don't know if I even knew it was a podcast. I found the Rare Life like Instagram page kind of early because it had the rare disease hashtags. And mm-hmm. it was like early 2020-ish maybe. So Gemma was about a year old.
And that's like when I first started, it was early 2020.
Right. And to parents who have like come into this like a little bit later, I know that's only like 3 years, but there was really not a lot rare disease wise around that time. This whole community had like just really started to like pop up around then. So like you were one of the earlier right. ones, and I was looking for people, obviously, because
as one does
when you like find out that your kid has a super rare disease. So I had just like started following you. I listened to like episodes like here and there. And also around that time, I had started a job as a podcast editor, which is a really roundabout way to get to that too, but like through a friend basically. And they were like, do you know how to edit podcasts? And I was like, I can learn. So at that point I had started that job. And then maybe a year or two after that, we had already like talked a little bit. I followed you. I listened mm-hmm. to your podcast and you put out that thing for like an editor, but you seemed hesitant about it.
I put it on like a, it was a random Facebook group. It was like a completely generic female podcaster group. out in the big old wide world, like nothing to do with disabilities or rare conditions or anything.
Yeah, it was one that I was just in because I was an editor and I was like, Madeline Cheney, why does that name sound so familiar? And then I put the pieces together and I was like, oh, I know her. And so at that point, I don't even think you had like asked for an editor specifically. I think you were like, how do you find an editor? And I was like, oh, I can help you find an editor. Like, that's what I do. I know lots of editors. And we just started talking and you were like, okay, but I'm really nervous to like pass this on to just like any random person. You were like, do you want to do it? And I was like, huh. I actually hadn't really thought about it at that point because I wasn't.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, because I wasn't like working full time yet. Like we had just gotten a nurse. So I was just starting to like do more work because we were like transitioning into like nursing care for Gemma. So I was like, oh, yeah, I could do it. I was like, that's super exciting. That's something I'm passionate about, obviously, like rare disease. And I like podcasts. So I was like, yeah, absolutely. And that's how we started. What, a year and a half ago, maybe, is when
I don't even know. Has it been that long? It's probably been that long.
Around that time. And then honestly, from there, it's just kind of expanded as it need to. Probably a good term for me is like, I'm like your implementer. You have all these ideas, like you all just do this like structural stuff. And then like, I'm the person who like puts the things together to like make sure it gets out there.
Yeah, you're like my manpower. Like, go do this.
Because I do a lot of different things here. I mean, it's just happened like pretty gradually. I think it started with like editing and then I started helping you writing like show notes and stuff like that. And then I had some like social media presence, but like my personal account is like I kind of use it sporadically to like write things on there. But I made a couple reels and you were like, I like your reels. Can you do some of the social media stuff for me? And I was like, yeah, sure. So we started doing that. And from there, it's just kind of like grown organically as it needs to. Kind of as the Rare Life has grown, right? Because it's really like built out a lot since even I started working with you. That was before you were a nonprofit. So
Yeah, a lot's been happening. Well, because of that, that's the thing, is it's not a coincidence that like it's grown a lot since you joined on, because I'm not just like in over my head editing the episodes. Like that's what I was spending like so much time doing, is like editing the dang episodes and then like writing all the different things for it. And like it took so much time. And so I'm working the same amount now, but now it's like so much more like orchestrating and like brainstorming on like, I don't know, just all the things, like redesigning the website and becoming a nonprofit and like how do we make this like bigger and sustainable and stuff. So I think it's been like so good for it.
And even with like the discussion groups and stuff, like it's become, not that it wasn't like community focused more, but I think like there's just so many more options to like bring people in instead of just like putting things out now too.
Yeah,
it's become even more community focused that way. And it's really cool. I mean, I love like working with you and making the stuff that we do. It's awesome.
Thanks, Alyssa. I love that you work with us. It really is. It's like so life-changing. And like life-changing for the podcast too. Like personally for me, life-changing, because I'm not totally burnt out all the time. And this feeling of like, I have all these awesome ideas and I want to spend so much more time on like XYZ, but I can't, because I'm like literally just trying to keep my head above water, getting the episodes out. And so that obviously impacts like my mental health and stuff. So like personally, but then also like for the podcast, it's been so great.
I mean, the other thing too, it's like, so I work from home remotely, obviously, like sometimes really weird hours, but Gemma has a rare disease and she's 4 and a half. So like sometimes it's one of those things where it's like, I can't have like a normal job. So like this is like life changing for us too, because it's like stability that also works with our schedule.
Right. Like you were working last night while you're watching some show.
I was doing like website stuff.
Late into the night for the website.
Yeah.
So it's like super great. Well, and it's also really great backing up to like when you were like, could you do it? Because like I'm very like protective of the podcast, right? Because it like feels like a child. So I'm like, oh my gosh, can I like trust someone else to do this? And then same with like all those different things that I've like offloaded to you, is like, it's like really big emotional deal to me. I'm like, oh my gosh, can I trust someone else to do this? Like, because at first I thought I couldn't offload anything else but editing of the episodes. So each one has been a big deal and it's meant a lot that like, not only do you know the community, you're part of the community. So like, then I know that you're like sensitive to like the different topics and stuff is really important. Because, yeah, I think like some moments of like episodes, someone from the outside looking in might be like, oh, that's like snore. That's boring. I'm going to take this part out. But for us in the community, it's like, oh, no, like this part is so relatable. Leave this part in. So just things like that, I think, is really important to have someone who's like part of the community and also a listener. And it's also been great because I messaged you a lot about like, hey, like, what do you think about the title of this episode? Or like, do you think that listeners would like a sticker club? Or like just different things, like running by ideas of like I don't know, like you're our target audience. So that's been really helpful too.
You know, there's an interesting parallel here too to like the way that we've built up trust with each other and also the way that like you have to build up trust with like your medical team and stuff like that too. Like
there you go. There. Yeah.
Well, it's like such a process, especially when you're rebuilding. It's like piece by piece. You add all these like little things and like people prove to you that they can do it. And then you just keep like going from there. So.
Oh my gosh. There's how it all goes together. It's not a 180. There's that tie-in. Trust. Yes, yes, you build it up and you're like, they've proven that to me, I can keep giving them more, or like I can rely on them more. I like that. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you for this great conversation. This is a good little smorgasbord of like story episode and I don't know, like kickoff or finale type of episode, but I am grateful for your vulnerability in sharing this story, and it's the first time sharing it like in such detail on a public platform, so I'm grateful for your bravery. And I'm grateful for all you do for the podcast. So, sappy moment.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me, Madeline.
You can connect with Alyssa or me by following the links in the show notes. You can also find links to Alyssa's podcast, Caffeinated Caregivers, and also a link to an older episode with tips for traveling with our disabled kids that Alyssa guested on back in season 7. Thank you to Alyssa for putting those show notes together. And thank you to Alyssa for editing all these lovely episodes, including your own episode, and for all you do for the podcast. Join us next week for an episode about religion and spirituality and how that is impacted by our children with disabilities. For this episode, we have 4 different guests, each with their own mini interview, and all coming from a different perspective. There is something for everyone in this episode. Don't miss it. See you then.